Good morning. This is Kieran Riley, and thanks for listening, folks. It's Tell It Like It Is, and our guests today are Alistair McIntosh with Verena Nicholas and Chris Reed. Chris Reed is a local friend of ours and a listener who has invited these two wonderful folks to come and talk about their work in Scotland. So thank you all for joining us today, and welcome.
Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. So Chris, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about why you brought our friends today and what they're doing?
Well, I can't just take the credit entirely. Jim Cashin and Meg Cashin are been instrumental in the visit of Alistair and Veren here for a few days. It's been a very precious time for us to get reacquainted. After 7 and 9 years absence, Alistair was here under the auspices of Friends of Hudson in 2003, and then in 2005. If listeners will recall that we were in the thick of the St. Lawrence battle in 2003, but by 2005 we had successfully concluded that particular campaign. And as things happened, Alistair was here on some other important businesses, very much related to his initial visit. So we had time with him in 2005. So the long story short, it's been quite a while. And this time he's brought his partner, his wife, Veren. They work, they're extremely dedicated individuals, very inspiring individuals in the kind of work that they do. They work complementarily. They have very distinct approaches to their work of community empowerment and social justice and environmental protection. And we've been doing a lot of sharing in the last few days, really in a very kind of low-key way, with a series of meetings to talk about activism and traction in the face of what sometimes seems like overwhelming challenges. So these have been very potent conversations we've had. They've been small. This is a small conversation too. There are just six of us here, but hopefully through this hour, we can reach a lot more people with some of the things that Veren and Alistair offer us all.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Maybe we'll just jump right in and go right to the Lafarge issue, and maybe you could explain a little bit of what you are doing here and what you bring to the table here.
Oh, well, it's quite a long story, Kieran, so I'll have to jump across some leaps. But basically, way back in 1991, an English company called Redland proposed what would be the biggest roadstone quarry in the world in a national scenic area on the island of Harris and Lewis, where I come from in the Outer Hebrides. Now, we fought that because we thought it wasn't appropriate to destroy such natural beauty. In the course of doing that, it pushed down Lafarge's share price, it pushed down Redland's share price, and Lafarge then bought the company. So we were no longer dealing with the English, we were dealing with the French. We were no longer saying no to the super quarry, we were saying no to the super quarry. Subsequently, a French banker read my book, Soil and Soul, in which I told a story that far, and it still wasn't resolved. And he said, you know, Lafarge is so proud of its environmental credentials that if they really knew in Paris what was being proposed for Scotland, they wouldn't let it happen. So he arranged meetings for me with their head office. Their head office people came to see for themselves, and hugely to their credit, they said, you know, this is not consistent with our international standards as a global company. We will withdraw. And we said to them, well, we will arrange a dignified exit strategy. Well, those were fatal words, because they came back to me and said, Alistair, you said you'd arrange a dignified exit strategy, which you have done, but we all use quarry products. We all use cement and stone. How should we do it more responsibly with respect to both the environment and communities? Will you serve on our sustainability stakeholder panel? So that was a real challenge. Was it just greenwash, or was it something meaningful? Mm-hmm. I consulted with my fellow activists, and they said, accept the invitation, but don't take any money from them. Mm-hmm. Only take your travel and accommodation expenses, things like that, that are receipted against. Don't take any fees. In fact, I've even refused charitable contributions from them. I haven't wanted to take anything at all. It has just been a privilege to serve in this capacity, and that's what brings me this week to speaking to the plant at Ravenna, where I know they've been wrestling with issues of mercury.
Okay, maybe we should quickly just describe to some listeners who may not be familiar, where is Ravenna and what is over there?
Well, that's something I guess I can answer. That's Ravenna is on the west side of the river. It's about a half an hour north of where we are in Hudson. Friends of Hudson itself has been involved with the Lafarge issues since before we even concluded our business with St. Lawrence / Holcim. We were interested in some of their records of emissions, and we also studied very closely their tire burning proposal to include tires in their mix of fuels. This goes back before 2005. But in recent years, really because this is the 50th anniversary of the original plant that was built there by Atlas, I believe, and it was then subsequently owned by other companies and purchased in 2001 by Lafarge, that the plant has had a bad history of emissions. It had the distinction of being one of the worst mercury polluters in 2007, 400 pounds. So this was something that was, of course, intense concern to immediate residents, not just on that side of the river, but also with the air currents on our side of the river in northern Columbia County and Schenectady. So Friends of Hudson and other community organizations have been very much involved with the plans of the company to replace their current kiln with a modernized kiln. And it's in that context that Alistair is here to talk about where they are in the timeline. The permits have been acquired. We involved the community as much as we could in the comments at the various stages and so forth. There's a timeline now that is a little bit unclear that we're going to find out about. And another dimension to this is the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency's recent decision to postpone across the board standards for the industry in this country on mercury and other persistent toxics. And we want to discuss with Lafarge their take on this move as well. That's one of the things we'll be finding out about.
Alistair, I'd like to ask, this is a common question when it comes to environmental issues and job issues and community. What I wanted to ask is how you, first of all, do you feel that Lafarge is really listening to what you have to say how was that resolved, or was it resolved in the situation where you come from?
Well, as soon as Friends of Hudson got on to me and said, look, Alistair, you're on this Lafarge panel that deals with sustainability stakeholder issues, and the community here is not happy about mercury, I said to the Lafarge executive, what is going on here? Now, I have to say that every time I have asked a question that's been thrown to me by Friends of Hudson, Lafarge have given me a very full technical response on the issues. There has not been any issue that they have not addressed. The only question that I've really got, because I'm not an expert in mercury, I simply recognize that having taken over Ravenna from Blue Circle and being told that the plant was emitting 40 pounds of mercury a year, when Lafarge tested it, they found it was emitting something like 400, and they said, we need to do something on this. Now, that strikes me as being an honest position to take. And the only question I've got now, which is within my field of competence to address when I speak with Lafarge this week in Ravenna, is to say, are you being fully transparent with the local community? Because Lafarge head office in Paris has recognized that whereas they cannot always be perfect, they do need to be honest. And this is at the basis of their code of ethics, that is the business code of ethics, that is on their website. It's built into their lobbying charter that is on their website. And what Lafarge are trying to do, in my understanding, and the reason why I stand with them on this, is that they are trying to raise the level playing field that the industry everywhere is playing on. by setting a good example. And I just want to make sure that they understand the importance of continuing that and that they are fulfilling it with the local community. And if there are gaps in that, that they will address those gaps.
Are you aware of any history? Are they consistent with their talk historically with other plants? Are they within, do they keep within guidelines?
What has astonished me in the 9 years that I've served on the panel is that on only 4 or 5 occasions have I as a panel member been approached from anywhere in the 70 or so countries you operate around the world about issues. I've been approached about 2 issues in India, 1 in Africa, this one here, and 1 that was in Brittany. In all of those cases, when I've raised it with them, they have given me the story, including the often difficult decisions that they are faced with on it. Now, I actually find that impressive because if you Google Lafarge and sustainability, my website, Alistair McIntosh, where I put all of my engagements, including the expenses I get paid on my website, comes up very prominently. So anybody with issues that they had wanted to raise with the stakeholder panel would easily know how to contact not just anybody on the industry panel, but somebody with an activist track record of having successfully challenged Lafarge in the case of the proposed Super Quarry on House.
Well, at this point, maybe you can go into the background of how you came onto this panel a little, if you can give a little more detail about what actually happened in the island that you lived on and how you engaged the community in pushing the proposed plant at that time out. And in fact, how did things break down in the community? How did people feel about the plant? Were there pros and cons? Were people supporting it or against it?
The proposal for the plant hugely divided the community. Initially, when I first heard of it, I was all in favor because of jobs. When we looked into it more deeply, we found that modern quarrying is so highly mechanized that there were going to be very few jobs. In fact, the government public inquiry discovered that far from there being 400 or 500 jobs, such as Redland, the English company, had first promised, there were only going to be 37 jobs created in the local community. The rest would be all stuff contracted outside. There would be very little benefit for a local community destroying the basis of its tourism, the basis of its fishing industry, because shipping would mean that the prawn trawling would be restricted, etc. So what happened is that whereas initially a vast majority of the local community were in favour of the quarry in Scotland, as time went on and people became educated about it, they resolutely turned against it. Now when Lafarge took Redland over, and Lafarge looked at what was happening there and came for themselves from Paris to see, they came to agree with the community. Except, you know, they got back to me and said, well, Alistair, will you come on our panel and advise us how we can do this better? Now, I see corporate social responsibility as having 2 sides. It's not just what the corporations do, but all of us are consumers. So we all have to be responsible too. We cannot blame it all on the corporations and the government. We must look in the mirror of our own consumption, see our own faces reflected back, recognize our own needs for things like cement and stone and so on, and say, look, folks, instead of dealing with this on an adversarial manner, such as so often happens, of lawyers fighting it out, how can we move towards negotiated ways of figuring out what we can best do to address these situations that face us all over the world today?
Wow, well, thank you. That was really beautiful. And it ties a little bit into, well, it ties directly into the work you're doing now. And maybe Varane can speak a little bit about where you're living right now and the type of work you're doing, because this comes down to not just organizing a strong enough group together to fight something that's really powerful because you don't want it in your backyard. Maybe Christina can talk about the NIMBY concept of not in my backyard. But this comes to the deeper meaning of what is community? What are our communities? Are we being told the truth by some of these corporations? And how do we, I'll let you do the talking. What are you at? Where are you actually living right now? And why?
Okay, thank you, Kieran. Yeah. We both live in an area of Scotland called Glasgow. In fact, we live in Glasgow, Scotland, and in an area called Govan, which is a post-industrialized community. There used to be massive shipyards there. And it's a marginalized community in the sense that there are high levels of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, a lot of very serious illnesses, and basically low-income families primarily live in this area. And we moved there about 7 years ago because we are connected with a wonderful local community organization called the Galgale Trust. Alistair is one of the founding members of the Galgale. And they do really inspiring work with recovering drug addicts and alcoholics, training people in skills like metalworking and woodworking. And fundamentally, this organization, as we see it, is recreating community. The people who go and train in the organization are people who are feeling very disconnected from their original families. They live very chaotic lives with a lot of isolation, and really carry the symptoms of brokenness that mm-hmm. has been created from historical and economic factors. And what the organization does is that it enables them to find community and family again. It enables them to get a sense of what they can do with their hands, but also how you can be respected and you can be valued as a human being for being able to contribute to society. Yeah, and this organization is also a place where people have meals together and can play music together, and so it attracts every Thursday night there is a communal meal and attracts people who are not necessarily living in this area but are also very thirsty for community, because we all are.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
all are. So we moved there because of the Galgale Trust fundamentally, and I also work with other community organizations in Govan, like a local community garden and other organizations trying to do popular education and a number of other cultural activities.
Wow, thank you.
Varen, I wanted to ask if you and Alistair could both talk a little bit about the economic and historical factors that go into that cause the breakdown of community. And because a lot of what we're talking about with these industries is coming in brings up the idea that communities that used to get their living, now we're looking at a post-industrial society and how that impacts the people who live there. What kind of polarization does that create? What is the spirit of poverty or the lack of spirit in poverty that you seem to be addressing in this program that you're running?
Okay, I'll ask Alistair to start.
A large area of my work has been about land reform in Scotland, because I think at the heart of poverty you have the phenomenon of people being driven off the land, whether it's the original native inhabitants or whether it's the people who would now call the working classes, being pushed off the land and the land becoming owned by a small number of elite who then charge rent. Now, rent is basically a tax on the poor. Rent is the main driving factor in creating worldwide poverty. And when we look at somewhere like Govan in Glasgow as a post-industrial area, what I'm seeing there is people who were originally poor Highlanders, poor Irish, who came over because they had been driven off the land by various forms of colonization, predominantly by the rich, creating a social class system. And now, as the working classes, even the need for their work because of modern industrialization and globalization has gone out. The tide has gone out on industry on our River Clyde. And this leaves these people as sometimes described as an underclass, a people who have had the rug pulled under them of the resource base, the connection with place and the land that would allow them to make an honest living. And so they're reliant on state benefits, they lose their self-respect, they start self-harming, drug addiction, all the rest of it. They are seen by the well-to-do, by the middle classes, are the problem instead of being seen as human beings. And our work is about regenerating what it means for everybody to live wholly as a human being.
Thank you. Thanks. So this is in Glasgow primarily. I should also just mention that Alistair was part of, founded a group called the Isle of, pronounce this name for me. I want to say Egg.
It's Egg. Isle of Egg Trust.
The Isle of Egg Trust was founded and was ousted the landlord there, which I understand is the first case in Scottish history.
Okay. Of a community getting it together and saying we are not going to tolerate having our 7,500-acre island ruled over by a single landowner. And so mounting a community buyout bid, which scared off all the other buyers, so at the end of the day, the community were able to work the market against itself and buy the island for half of what might have been its natural price, because the natives were restless. We've been learning from Native Americans on our Scottish land rights. So thank you to any Native Americans listening here.
Alistair and Varen, I want to ask you both to get more into the meat of community activism, why you became a community activist, also you, Varen, and also how do you, education is so important. How do you organize people? People sometimes vote against their own interests. You see that a lot in this country. Also, maybe the differences in the populations. You have more of a uniform population generally in Europe, and in this country, it's easy to let racism divide people. Can you talk to those issues, please?
I'll start with why I became a community activist, and it's not an easy question to answer. I think it's happened. I think I was driven from my heart. I actually grew up in Africa, and I'm French originally, so I'm, and my parents were really interested in social justice issues, world development issues. My mother was a pediatrician, and my father was working in adult education. So I must have something in my genes to start with, because I did encounter issues of poverty and in fact a separation between different groups of people when I was a child, and I must have become somewhat mobilized in my whole organism to see the injustice in the way our society was working, and also the effect of post-colonized Africa and what it was doing to people. So I think that's where it started, really. And then I went on my journey, studied agriculture, but it led me to community development. Worked in a spiritual community for a whole year alongside very marginalized people in Ireland, and eventually moved to Scotland and continued to work in marginalized communities. And I see the heart of my work being about education. In fact, you mentioned the word, and specifically an education that is about opening the minds and the hearts, opening consciousness. And I see education as something that needs to be transformative, as distinct to a kind of education that is about reinforcing the status quo and reinforcing the divides of all kinds. So it's a very, in my understanding, it's a very skilled thing to deliver an education that will emancipate the human spirit. And in my work in Govan, before people feel ready to come and participate in meaningful dialogue and to open up about the issues that matter to them, there needs to be a process by which we build trust. So I suppose a lot of my work has been about creating the conditions by which people come together in a very simple way around a meal and around something that is meaningful for them, and then we pull them together and say what matters to you, what makes you click, what are you passionate about, or what are you angry about. And the education is actually unfolding from what people really what they see in their own world, and my role as an educator is to facilitate dialogues and discussions and training events that is really building from where people are at, and that will empower them, giving some skills, some resources that will enable them to slowly get a sense of what the issues are, slowly get a sense that it's not their fault, but there's actually a whole context that has created the conditions by which they are still in poverty, and very importantly, to say, what are we going to do about it?
Could I just repeat one of my favorite words in that, which was food?
Yes.
Say again. So you
the
do
magic of food.
You do meals.
Yes.
Where you work?
Well, in fact, in Govan there are two evening meals. There's one that's happening at the Galgale Trust, which I mentioned before, right. And then there's another one happening on a Tuesday evening. So there are two opportunities every week in the same community to gather around food. Mm. And what food does is it creates a non-threatening opportunity for people to come together, have a meal. Some people don't eat well at all, mm-hmm, so it's maybe the one opportunity in the week where they're going to get a proper meal to start with. But also it's just an opportunity to be seen as a human being, to be valued for just who we are, and it's safe, and in within and we have fun. We create, you know, space for music or cultural events, celebrating the Scottish poet Robert Burns one evening. So that also created community, powerfully. Mm-hmm. So the food is primarily what brings us together. Yeah. And once we create togetherness, we can start unfolding mobilization. We can start unfolding conversations, friendship, and everything that needs to be done in a community like Govan.
Yeah, excellent. And we have an international dinner here in Hudson, but it's only once a year. And I've heard just so many positive comments from people who have experienced eating together around a table with folks who they would never otherwise eat together with. Mm-hmm. The power of that bringing people together. And we have also a vibrant agriculture. Maybe even Chris Reed wants to comment. He's, you know, living out in Philmont. And you know, they just a lot of the food scene in Philmont, with the farmers market and the pub there, is really picking up. I don't think this is like an elitist trend or something like that. And I just wanted to repeat, because I do an agriculture show, of course, I'm biased towards the power of agriculture and food. And I feel like maybe perhaps we have something like that in our communities just percolating. I don't know.
I think so. But actually, as I was listening to Varan, I was thinking about my experiences with Occupy Wall Street, about this idea that people are coming together to create community from scratch, it seems to me. And so there was almost like this spontaneous eruption in late September, early October of 2011 in New York City, where you had the food actually as a center of that community building. My sense is that the people that were drawn there you would never have encountered otherwise. And I think the whole experience of homelessness has been effectively kind of marginalized almost to the point of non-existence until at least my personal encounter with Occupy, where you actually saw people who were homeless and you had a conversation with them, and you didn't know whether they were homeless or not. They sometimes seemed like graduate students, or the graduate students were homeless. You know, it was a very strange kind of mixture of facades that where you could actually begin to see what was percolating underneath. Whereas in the case of Philmont, I think you're right. It's a blue-collar community. Gene Gablett and my partner and I were attracted precisely because it was not a hoity-toity community. It was a gritty community. It was a working community that had seen better days. And we saw that there was a long period of a plateau where nothing seemed to happen. It was very much parallel to the situation in the city of Hudson. And only in very recent years have we seen the evidence of some really profound change. And food is the leading, I think, driver of that. I think the fact that we are surrounded by fertile, well-farmed acreage, we have all of these connections to people who are really walking the talk as far as cultivating really healthy food. Philmont is a beneficiary of that. So it's not an accident that in a space of 2 years, you had the resurgence of four restaurants there. a couple of them which are really dedicated to, at least, to local food. And I would do a shout out to the Main Street Pub, particularly because of its success in sort of keeping the community together, where you can rub shoulders with a whole spectrum of the community.
What's up, Matt and Liz?
Yes. So, yes, I do think that this is the pattern that we're seeing, is this revitalization. Just one other comment, sort of off of the subject. You know, I was straining to think about the other communities that I think are similar to the ones that Alistair and Varen are describing in Glasgow. And of course, we have many such communities. And just the other day, I saw an article, which I haven't read, but it was saying, don't underestimate the city of Detroit and say it's not a food desert. Hmm. In fact, what's happening in this is one of the poster cities of the post-industrial era, is that those abandoned lots are literally being recreated as farms. And there's a vital community that's going on with that. So we have lots of frames of hooks to connect with what Alistair and Varen are doing in Scotland. And I hope we can touch on those, especially locally.
Thanks, Chris. I wanted to take this just a step deeper, because one of the reasons why I think Kieran and I do these programs is because we do want to get the word out about how to create change. And last week, Bill McKibben, I had a Bill McKibben talk on that was recorded down at Bard. And Bill talked, he's from Vermont, and he talked about how wonderful his local area was and how much he supported the agriculture there. But because of climate change, we've got a train in the background, the local community supported local organic farms were literally wiped out by Hurricane Irene.
That's just CSX, folks. It's a normal daily occurrence, and we're currently redlining on the board, but it'll be by in approximately 4, 3, 2, 1 second.
I just love the sound of your American trains. They're so evocative. You can bring them over to Scotland. They're fantastic.
Our train system here is on par with that of Bulgaria, I believe, but and that's not necessarily a good thing, but if you want them...
So the question that Bill McKibben brought up, though, is he contrasted local organizing and said that it may actually be a little bit too late. He didn't say that he was going to give up on local organizing, but that the depth and the width of the problems in the world right now also require some real actions, international actions. And so I wanted maybe for you to address that, that maybe not everything is going to come, or the change that we need to happen in the world may not come that quickly enough through just doing local community actions.
Well, I listened to Bill McKibben and others speaking at an event near here just a couple of days ago. And what struck me is that there is a need for a much deeper analysis of what climate change actually represents. I think with recent events in the United States, people are beginning to get over the idea that climate change maybe isn't happening. The vast majority of informed scientists in the world tell us that it is, based upon their measurements. I myself have written a book on climate change called Hell and High Water, and the subtitle of my book is Climate Change, Hope and the Human Condition. And the question is, where does the hope come from? The way I see it is that it is already too late if the mainstream science is correct. It is already too late to stop what is already starting to come upon us. So we're kidding ourselves on if we think we can deal with this by the conventional economic, scientific, technical, political types of fixes. Most of all, the electorate wouldn't buy it unless some kind of dictatorship was imposed on them. Now, that's a very hard thing to say to a lot of green activists. It's not to say we don't continue to do the maximum we can to limit emissions. One of the things that we've been working on Lafarge is we've moved them to a stage where they have cut by 23% their carbon dioxide emissions per unit of cement on 1990 levels. And their next target is to bring that up to 33% by 2020. But that is still only scratching the surface of what needs to be done. And what I think needs to be done is we need to build the resilience in our communities to cope with come what may in the come to pass. We've got to build the strength of relationship between us so that we stick together in our responses, so that if extreme weather events hit, if food shortages come about, we've got the capacity to care for one another to deal with that. And that is fundamentally psychological and indeed spiritual work. It's taking what Varen was saying about the heart of activism, what opens up in the heart when we connect with our neighbor who is less well off with us, and recognize that fundamentally we are a spiritual unity. We are all members one of another, was how St. Paul put it. The Muslims say that all Muslims are as one body. The Hindus say that all Atman, all individual souls, are a part of Brahman, the universal soul. Jesus talked about us all being branches on the same vine of life. We have to start looking our neighbor in that, and we have to challenge ourselves in things like the ownership of disproportionate wealth, in the use of our education, if we happen to be middle class, in ways that to further our individual advantage instead of being to serve the community. And we have to say, how can we use everything we have got to serve the community and to build the resilience by which we can make through whatever is going to be happening to the world's environment, we can see ourselves through into a more humane and an environmentally sustainable future.
Okay. Part of you also wrote a book called Soil and Soul, and what you're saying just now, what's striking me from that book is you also mention how we've kind of become, I'm quoting here, there's an analogy to an orchard. You said that society has kind of become like a monoculture, and we're all been put in strict, straight lines and rows, and our branches have been pruned to be exactly to produce what the orchardist desires to produce. So there's also this sort of consciousness of individuality that you believe need to come out.
And you know, this is where your American understanding of freedom, which is so often misinterpreted as freedom for the rich to exploit, needs to be deeply understood. Your constitution is a very beautiful constitution if you really follow it through to the depth that it should be about freedom for all. Mahatma Gandhi said, before you do anything, consider the face of the poorest person you know and ask, is your action going to benefit that person? If it will, it is right action. If it is not, it is self-interested action. So this is why we must seek to bring out the beauty of every human being. And if we see somebody sitting on the street, blowing their lives on tins of alcohol or whatever, because of what has happened to them in their life, because they've never had a start in life, we have to see that not as their problem only, but also as our collective problem, so that we can collectively raise our society and find freedom and justice and love for all.
Mm-hmm. Alistair, can you talk a little bit more about what it takes to come out of one's own individual needs and desires, our own ego-based existence? I mean, this is what human beings are. It's important, I think, for all of us to face, you know, that we don't always act in the needs of the community, but in fact, if we realize that maybe like alcoholics, we could start from understanding what we really are, or
you're right. I mean, I grew up, my father was a country doctor. Politically, he would have been what you would call Republican here, and pretty right-wing Republican. I grew up believing that black people were inferior to white people, that the working classes were what they were because it deserved to be the working classes and was there to serve our entitlement, etc. You see, this was pretty mainstream right-wing thinking. And those were the values with which I went to university. And then what happened was I started to experience different people on the other side of the fence. Now, that is a real choice. Do you allow yourself to experience and hear the stories of people who are less well off than you, or do you block yourself off? Do you only stay in your own privileged bubble? Well, I chose to allow myself to experience it. I subsequently went and worked for 4 years in Papua New Guinea with some desperately poor people there. And, you know, it opens up your understanding in your mind, but more important than that, it opens up your heart. And I believe that this is what the spiritual journey is all about. If we're serious about our religions, it's not about going to the church or the synagogue or the mosque on every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whatever it is. It is about living out an authentic relationship with our neighbour and being as concerned for our neighbour's well-being as we are for our own. To love your neighbour as yourself. That's what it's about to me.
Can I add something to this? My story is not dissimilar to Alistair's, but at least he had the privilege to grow up in a community that was still really strongly connected to one another and the land. I did grow up in Africa, and yet my family was not really connected to a wider community. So I had to relearn, literally from scratch, I think, how to really be in community. And that took quite a lot of inner work, because I just didn't have it in me to know how to relate to other beings in a fully compassionate way and in a natural way, flowing relationships. There is a lot of shyness in me, and my natural tendency is to rely on myself. Yeah, and I think to truly rebuild community links, we need to fundamentally challenge ourselves on this reality of interconnectedness. What does it really mean to be connected with our fellow human beings? And that takes some courage for some of us who have not been familiarized with what it means to be in community to dive in. And we are going to be challenged in our ways of being, in our ways of using our power, be it because we have a good education or whether because we're white or male or whatever the root of our privilege is. And so it's going to be a journey of needing to find a place of humility, a place of being able to find some support, to build the muscles, the kind of inner muscles that we need to have to be able to relax in the presence of other people and work with other people and live with other people who might be really different from us.
Well, in the remaining time that we have, I'd like to take this conversation back to the people and major corporations. And my question is, in any organizing, community organizing that I've done, I've always realized that it takes a tremendous amount of work. It's person to person by person. There's a lot of talk about social media and getting on Facebook and organizing revolutions in that way, but you'll find out, even with the Arab Spring, that a lot of it was already in place, that the trade unions were already organizing, and the students, and so I want you, if you could, please address the work that takes, and then I want to talk, if you could, a little bit about how does this look, this in the face of a Goliath of industry? I mean, it's all well and good that Lafarge is concerned about the environment, but you know, the fact of the matter is that most industry, probably inherent in capitalist thought, will go for the bottom line, the profit, in every situation. And we are just another resource, human beings, the environment, animals, just to be used up.
Well, I think, you know, that's the old capitalist paradigm, that you go for the single bottom line of profit. The emerging paradigm is you go for the triple bottom line, whereby you do need profit, otherwise you go out of business. So let's not be stupid about it, that if a business doesn't stay profitable, it can't remain trying to do good things. But you also need the bottom lines of care for the environment, so we can sustain living on this earth as human beings in healthy environments. And you need the bottom line of care for your surrounding communities. Now, Lafarge, if you read their Sustainability 2020 ambitions, if you Google those words, you'll get it up on the website, they're committing themselves effectively to that triple bottom line. The task of a panel like the one that I'm on, the Sustainability Stakeholder Panel, is to hold them to that and to advise them on it. Now, how do we know that's not just greenwash? Mm-hmm. you hear the kind of radical things I see. I say exactly the same things to the Lafarge board every year when, under the chairmanship of the chief executive, Bruno Lafont, we meet in Paris and we discuss it. I say exactly the same things. I give them a hard time. That is the acid test. If they didn't have people on that panel who give them a hard time, or Dr. Frank Rose, former head of industrial medicine at ICI, giving them a hard time on issues like mercury, etc., it would not be a credible process. Now, what I would say is that that kind of example, and Lafarge is not unique in this respect, that kind of example is the kind of corporation that we want to see. Ultimately, personally, I would like to see it go far further than that, because capital always serves itself. Mm-hmm. I see fundamental problems in the capitalist paradigm by which money not only has a primary quality as a medium of exchange, but has been allowed since medieval times to develop a secondary quality known as usury, of expecting a return, well said, expecting a return on investment. You know, the bank doesn't only look after your money, so robbers don't steal it, but you expect the bank to generate a real positive rate of return on it. And that means that somebody somewhere gets screwed. And that is our problem. This, to me, is why it is so important that we have things like ethical investment, social forms of investment. We have things like farmers market. I went around your one in Hudson here. It was wonderful. You know, we bought a soft toy from a woman for a friend from $25. It was a little bit more than we could afford for that gift. But Varen just felt the woman she was buying from it was just, it was such a right relationship that this would make for a wholesome gift. And I would say it's better that we live in right relationship with justice. Buying things like from places like farmers market or from ethical corporations than it is to always go for the cheapest and then feel proud that we give some money to charity. Put justice before charity, and that is how we start to transform the world.
Mm-hmm. From my own angle, I'd like to say yes, it's hard work to work with communities, and it takes time, and it takes the one-to-one conversations to really enable people to get involved. But also, I think these conversations for me are about helping people to feel really heard in their concern. And again, it's about building trust. So I can't really talk about the links with industry. I'll just much more elaborate on this one, as you just heard. But for me, the work that's really important in mobilizing communities is around helping and equipping people to work together effectively. What I encounter in governance and other communities is a number of people are desperate for change to happen and to take a part in changing the situation. And yet, they keep sabotaging their own projects, they keep sabotaging really important initiatives because they are not properly resourced and equipped to overcome conflict or to work across differences and communicate what is really important to them in a way that's done with respect and with truth, but also to be able to really understand where the other person is coming from. So there is something about building the capacity of individuals and organizations and communities as a whole to become a lot stronger in our capacity to collaborate and work together. And unless we have that, unless we have these resources, it's very difficult to go and dialogue with, you know, the capitalist organizations. We need to be able to negotiate, to listen, to put a case together, to build strengths together. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my work is actually about equipping communities and organizations in the skills to collaborate effectively.
Thank you, Varen. I just want to remind our listeners we are down to the 5-minute point pretty much, and our local friend Chris Reed has brought Alistair McIntosh and Verena Nicholas all the way from Scotland, who are here in very important work with Lafarge and with community building and local workshops. I understand you're on your way to Canada as well?
Yes, we have both been invited to run workshops here. I will be running, I'll be speaking at an agriculture college, but I'll also be running a workshop at the Tatamagouche Centre in Nova Scotia on what I call spiritual activism, which is that when we are engaged in activism as a commitment to life, a bit like a soldier might commit towards fighting wars for life, if you're going to work for peace, it's a lifelong commitment. Often you run out of resources, you run out of money, you become burnt out and all the rest of it. So how do we resource ourselves from the deepest roots of what it means to be a human being? And I believe that to be commitment to the spiritual. Varenne can describe to you what she will be doing in Canada.
That would be great.
Yes, I will also be running a workshop in the Tatamagouche Centre, and this time using dance, which I teach as well, as a way of helping people reconnect with what makes them feel fully alive. So I really believe in the power of music, the power of dance, and the power of connection in a form like dance, to really help people kind of bring their spirit, their soul alive again. And we'll also be sharing on these issues.
Thank you. Chris, did you have any other questions also or comments that you want to add before we start to close?
Well, we were talking earlier, Varenne and Alistair and I and others, about the collapses that we're seeing around the world, like the Greeks with their financial system and the Russians, and so forth, and this hidden resilience that some of these communities have because of their connection to the land. Mm. And it's not just the land itself, it's the traditions of the skills that have been maintained unbroken. This is sort of the hidden strengths of these societies. And I would just submit, when we get back to the question of food, that our area is very well endowed, actually, in those traditions and those connections. And I think we're going to be making more of them, more use of them in the future. And I think the message that Alistair and Varenne deliver is that there's a lot of inner work that has to happen as well to facilitate that rebuilding. And so I hope the takeaway from their brief visit here is to know more about what those next steps will be for all of us to rebuild community from the ground up.
In the last minutes that we have, really just the last 2 minutes, I would open it up to Varenne and Alistair. I want to thank you both for coming, yeah, and maybe address a little bit of that inner work that we all need to do. What does that look like?
And how does it relate to corporate power?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be your thing. Yeah, for me, the inner work is about opening our hearts to the brokenness that we all carry, and to be able to work with the reality of life, the reality that we are, that we encounter difficult challenges, we encounter sometimes very difficult family situations, we encounter really difficult, challenging environment because of the society we live in, and how do we develop the courage, the humility, the inner strengths that are going to help us to stay or to build our own power, whilst being able to do the very delicate, loving work of inner compassion as well, when we actually fail to be in line with our own values, when we fail to establish the contact with another human being in a way that we know is going to be transformative. And so, and if we can cultivate this inner compassion, then it's much more possible to relate to other human beings, even if they are the people who run the corporations, in the way that's going to be able to see them and relate to them as human beings. I don't see how we can do any transformation if we don't ultimately see the humanness in all human beings.
Oh, I think I
that sounds
work.
Difficult. Christina, really sounds tough.
Like
Alistair?
It is tough. It's
is
really,
there hope,
it's
Alistair?
Really challenging.
Really? Is that what you're telling us?
I think, if I can just say how it relates to corporate power. Corporate power is an emergent property of all our individual purchase actions. It is not just the capitalist's grabbing hold of monopolies. That is one side of it. The other side of it is what we choose to buy, if we've got land, how we whether we choose to share it or whether we just keep it private, etc. And so I think that we've got to look at our own shadow sides. We've got to face up and name our own complicity in the system. You know, every time I put my foot on the accelerator of the car, I am complicit in that war that I oppose in Iraq. That kind of dynamic. And by owning our own complicity, then the people working in the corporations can start to become more humanized, and I would hope start to move gradually from capitalist models of business organizations towards mutualist and cooperative models.
I can't say any more. I think that's it. Thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah, Chris Reed, thanks a lot for bringing our guests today, and Alistair and Vrain. Really appreciate you being here, and
how can we, if good we luck wanted with to it. Continue to follow what you folks are doing.
Yeah, could you give us some contact information, perhaps,
yes,
in our last minute?
Yeah, VerenNicolas.org. That's spelled VerenNicolas.org. For her work, and Alistair McIntosh, that's AlastairMcIntosh.com.
It's not M-A-C? You're not a Mac? You're
oh,
a Mac?
No. You see, I'm not a Mac user myself. I say that PCs are for people who work on their computers, and Macs are for people who play on them. But my wife, who's got a Mac, completely disagrees.
Okay. All right. So what do you think, Christina? Are we there?
I think we're there.
Thanks again for listening to Tell It Like It Is. This is Kieran O'Reilly with Christina Malisoff. And thanks again to our guests. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.